Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today, we're talking about a material that has accompanied humanity for thousands of years. Leather.
Exactly. And not just as a material, but as, well, as a genuine piece of cultural heritage. Humans started processing animal hides as far back as the Stone Age, as a byproduct of hunting.
And they weren't stupid. They quickly realized that rawhide rots. So they had to find ways to preserve it somehow. By smoking it, for example, or with animal fats.
That was basically the earliest form of preservation. And in the Middle Ages, things became really professional. What many people don't know is that the German word Leder, from Old High German Leder, could refer to both tanned hide and fur with hair still attached. But craftsmen did distinguish between them. Tanners and furriers even belonged to separate guilds.
So there was no distinction between what we call leather today and fur?
Right. Linguistically, the line wasn't always clear. But the craftsmen knew exactly what they were doing. The guilds were clearly separated. Let's look at the various uses, though, because that's where it gets really interesting. Leather wasn't just for clothing.
But for practically everything. Bags, belts, saddles, straps for tools.
Book bindings, drum heads, even helmets in some cases. And of course, armor components. Arm bracers for craftsmen, leather aprons for blacksmiths.
The material was truly indispensable. When you think about it, we still have leather everywhere today. Shoes, jackets, bags, car seats.
The difference is, back then, there were no alternatives. No plastic, no synthetic fabrics. Leather was the durable, weatherproof material. And it even had another function that has completely disappeared today.
Which was?
Animal hides were used as currency. It was called pelt money. So basically like an early banknote, only made of fur.
Wait, you could pay with furs? How did that work?
There were fixed values. Certain types of pelts counted as units of currency. Sable, marten, squirrel. This was widespread in Scandinavia and Eastern Europe. People paid taxes with them, tribute, even fines.
Squirrel pelts as taxes. That's so different from anything we know today.
In Norway, transactions were calculated in hides. And in remote inland regions like Telemark, such payments in kind persisted especially long. Coined money simply arrived later there. And in Russia and Siberia, tribute payments in sable pelts continued in some places right up until the 19th century.
That shows just how valuable the material was. Not just practical, but a genuine store of value.
And then there's another use that personally fascinates me the most.
The cooking thing?
You know me too well. Yes, leather pouches were actually used for cooking.
Okay, but how was that supposed to work? Holding leather over a fire?
No, cleverer than that. You'd fill the leather pouch with water, then heat stones in a fire until they were glowing hot, and drop the hot stones into the water.
And the water would boil?
Exactly. The stones release their heat. The water starts to simmer. Then you throw in meat, vegetables, herbs, and when it cools down, you add more hot stones.
That's actually brilliant. No pot needed, no metal.
A real Stone Age soup, quite literally. And depending on the cut of meat, it took different amounts of time. Tender pieces were done in 30 minutes to an hour, but tougher cuts needed much longer.
In a leather pouch. You really have to wrap your head around that.
And that also explains why tanning became so important. Tanned leather is simply more durable. You can use stiff rawhide too, as long as it doesn't go directly into the fire, but it's much more vulnerable.
So tanning wasn't just for durability, but also for water resistance?
Among other things, yes. Tanned leather becomes both flexible and strong at the same time, resists water better, doesn't rot as quickly. It's only through tanning that a perishable animal hide becomes a long-lasting material.
And the actual tanning process, that couldn't have been simple.
Oh, it was a real ordeal, with some pretty nasty side effects. But that's a story in itself. But what did a medieval tannery actually look like? They weren't located in the middle of town.
No, definitely not. Tanneries were almost always built by rivers, or banished to the edge of town, often in their own districts, separated from everything else.
Because of the water they needed?
That too. They needed enormous amounts of water for the tanning process. But the main reason was something else. The stench. Tanneries reeked terribly. Rotting hides, decay, chemical solutions.
The trade had a pretty bad reputation because of that, didn't it?
It was considered an unclean profession. Dirty work, literally. Tanners didn't rank particularly high in the social hierarchy, even though their work was absolutely essential.
And on top of that, there was a real health risk. Anthrax. Tanners could become infected from contaminated animal hides.
Anthrax? That's the disease that's still feared today?
Exactly. Bacillus anthracis, the pathogen. The spores can survive in the environment for decades. And if a tanner worked on a contaminated hide, especially dry pelts, they could inhale the spores or absorb them through small cuts in the skin.
When you're working with knives and sharp tools, you constantly have little cuts.
And then this characteristic black scab would form, called an anthrax carbuncle. With the cutaneous form, it was still treatable, somehow. But the pulmonary form, when you inhaled the spores,
was fatal.
Almost always, within days. There were no antibiotics.
That puts the notion of it being a lowly trade in quite a different light. The tanners risked their lives.
Every day. And yet, or perhaps because of that, from the late Middle Ages onward, the trade became increasingly regulated in many regions. The guild system brought tanning under its control, though this varied by region.
The guild system was generally organized to ensure quality. For the tanners, from this point on, leather production was separated from leather processing.
So tanners and shoemakers suddenly belonged to different guilds?
Tanners, shoemakers, saddlers, bagmakers. In larger cities, often all separate, though smaller towns sometimes had combined guilds. And there were several reasons for this. Tanning is a completely different process from cutting and sewing. Different tools, different investments, different risks.
And of course, the conflicts of interest. The finishing trades wanted to buy cheap leather, the tanners wanted higher prices. Where the guilds were separate, they could negotiate better.
Within the Tanners Guild itself, there were also specializations. There were the tors, the bark tanners,
the chamois tanners, the fur dressers.
Exactly. Each with their own techniques and products.
And in Germany, this went even further. The specialization was mainly important within the cities, depending on what livestock and tanning barks were available. It was practical. Where lots of cattle were slaughtered, there were more large hides for the tanners.
And in the south?
The specialization within cities was often more important. Bark tanners with oak bark for heavy sole leather, tors with alum for soft, light-colored glove leather, these were strictly separated by guild rules. They weren't even allowed to process the same hides.
That's like departments in a modern company. Different guilds for different products. Everything clearly regulated, no one stepping on each other's toes.
The specialization made sense. When a town or craft district perfects the same techniques, sources the same raw materials, passes on the same know-how from generation to generation,
then quality keeps improving and the reputation spreads. If you wanted good harness leather in the Middle Ages, you went to the bark tanner. For fine glove leather, to the tor. People knew exactly who in their town was best at what.
The guilds also strictly controlled quality. Leather thickness, tanning duration, permitted additives, all prescribed. Violations were punished with fines. In the worst case, your right to sell was revoked.
That was essentially a kind of medieval consumer protection. The guild vouched for the quality of its members' work.
And at the same time, it protected members from too much competition. Anyone who wanted to work as a tanner in a town had to join the guild. It was called compulsory guild membership.
So, a closed system?
Pretty closed, yes. Apprenticeship, journeyman years, often traveling, then eventually the master examination, paying fees. This became more formalized over time. In the Middle Ages, a lot depended on the region and town. The system really became strict toward the early modern period.
That sounds like a long path, but also like a system that worked for centuries.
The craft simply professionalized. From a stinking trade on the outskirts to a well-organized industry with quality standards and specialization. Now it gets technical, the actual tanning process. And let me put it this way, this was no simple craft. It was chemistry before the word even existed.
What should I picture? What actually happens to the hide?
At its core, it's about making a raw animal hide durable. Untreated, it would rot, become stiff, decompose. In tanning, tanning agents are used that cross-link and stabilize the collagen in the hide. This makes it resistant to swelling and decay, and that's how hide becomes leather.
And that makes the leather waterproof and, well, usable at all.
Exactly. Tanned leather resists water, heat, microorganisms, and it becomes both flexible and strong at the same time. That's what's special about it. But getting there was a long process.
How many steps were involved?
Quite a few. First, the fresh hides were trimmed and unusable parts removed. Then they were preserved, either with salt or by drying. Or you worked on them immediately if you had the capacity.
Fresh hides spoil quickly.
Right, so speed was essential. The first real working step was called soaking. The hide went into water to restore its original moisture content. If it had been dried before, it was hard as a board.
That makes sense. Dry leather is stiff and brittle. Only with moisture does it become supple again.
Exactly. And then came the liming. That was a pit or vat filled with lime water. The hide would sit there for hours, sometimes days.
What does the lime do?
Two things. It loosens the fiber structure, essentially making the hide receptive to the later tanning agents, and it detaches the hairy outer layer. After liming, the hide was dehaired and softened. This was then called the pelt.
Pelt. So the bare hide, basically.
And then it had to be fleshed. On what was called the tanner's beam, a wooden block set at an angle, the hide was stretched out and worked with special knives. Everything that remained of flesh, fat, and connective tissue was scraped off.
That sounds like hard physical labor.
Absolutely. Hours of scraping in a hunched position. And after that... No, wait, I forgot a step. Before the actual tanning came the de-liming. The lime had to be removed from the hide.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
Why?
Because otherwise, the tanning agents can't penetrate properly. The pH level had to be brought back to a natural level. Only then was the hide ready for the actual tanning.
And there were different methods?
Yes, several. With chamois tanning, for example, tanning oils were used. Fish oil or also...
Brain matter? I've heard about that, but really? Brains?
Really brains. It sounds strange at first, but it works excellently. Animal brains contain large amounts of unsaturated fatty acids and phospholipids, lecithin, for example. When you work that into the hide and let it dry, these fats oxidize.
And this oxidation?
It bonds with the collagen in the hide, creates new connections, cross-links the tissue. The result is soft, supple leather. Very tough, yet still flexible.
So they instinctively knew what worked chemically, without knowing the chemistry.
Centuries of experience. With chamois tanning, fish oil or train oil was massaged in by hand. Brain tanning is a related but separate process. Then it was dried, washed, dried again, and then fulled, mechanically worked to make it soft. This took several days to weeks.
And the other method? Bark tanning?
That was completely different. Vegetable tanning agents. Oak bark, chestnut wood, various tree barks. These were ground in a bark mill and leached with water to create a tanning liquor.
And then the hides went into that?
Into the tanning pit, yes. And there they lay. Weeks. Sometimes months. The liquor was acidic from the tannins and gave off a terrible stench. Plus unhealthy fumes, hydrogen sulfide from decomposing protein, and ammonia during the pre-treatment in the lime pit.
No wonder tanneries were on the edge of town.
Nobody wanted that nearby. And the interesting thing...
is that we still do vegetable tanning today.
Yes, it's called vegetable tanning. Still used for high-quality leather. Takes longer than modern chrome tanning, but the result is different. Natural smell, ages more beautifully.
Chrome tanning is the industrial version then?
The fast one, using chromium salts. Takes hours instead of months. It was only developed in the 19th century. The majority of today's leather is made this way. But the traditional methods have retained their place.
What actually happened to all the waste? A process like that must produce quite a bit.
This is where medieval efficiency comes in. Nothing was thrown away. The flesh scraps, hide trimmings, everything from the fleshing and trimming, that was processed into gelatin or into hide glue.
They really used everything. Like with an animal after slaughter, from nose to tail.
The principle was the same. No waste. Everything has a use. Gelatin for food, hide glue as adhesive for woodworking, bookbinding. It was economically sensible, but also necessary. Resources were precious.
Sustainability avant la lettre.
You could say that. And the leather itself? Once the whole process was complete, you had a material that could last for generations. And besides the many practical uses we've already mentioned, there was another area where animal hide significantly shaped culture.
Oh, now I'm curious. You're probably thinking of its role in preserving knowledge?
Exactly, but not just as protection for books, as bindings.
Ah, you mean as the paper itself?
Exactly. The material on which the most important texts were written wasn't...
paper, but also animal hide.
And this special form of hide processing for writing was a craft all its own.
That's right. It wasn't tanned in the usual sense, but treated differently.
Did you know that parchment was made from untanned hide?
Parchment? So the writing material?
Exactly. The hide was treated differently. Not tanned, but stretched and dried. The result was a smooth, writable material, much more durable than paper. Some parchments from the Middle Ages are still readable today.
So basically the hard drive of the Middle Ages. All the important documents, charters, religious texts.
written on animal hide, yes. And the practical thing was, if you made a mistake, you could scrape off the ink and write again. That was called a palimpsest.
That also explains why leather was so valuable. It could do almost anything. And production was mainly local, right?
Regional, yes, for everyday needs. Every larger town had its tanneries. But high-quality leather, Cordovan from Spain, for example, was traded over long distances. For ordinary needs, though, people worked with whatever material was available locally.
That also explains why certain tanners in a town had such a good reputation. If a bark tanner produced particularly good sole leather, word got around, and demand came from outside the area too.
Exactly. But for everyday items, shoes, belts, pouches, the leather came from the nearest tannery. Short distances, direct relationships between craftsmen.
And was the material valued?
Absolutely. Strength and weather resistance were the main reasons. Leather withstood wind and rain, was hard-wearing, could be repaired. That was precious in a time when you couldn't just go out and buy something new.
When I think about it, the cooking in the leather pouch thing really shows how practical their thinking was. A material that withstands decent heat, at least indirectly, becomes quite water resistant when properly treated, and barely rots. Why wouldn't you use it in the kitchen too?
They made a virtue of necessity. No metal pot, no problem, the leather pouch will do.
And the fascinating thing is, this craft lives on. Vegetable tanning still exists. The techniques have been refined, but the principle has stayed the same.
Proven over centuries. And anyone who holds a fine piece of leather today, whether for reenactment, LARP, or simply because it's beautiful, is part of a long tradition.
That's exactly what I find so exciting about this topic. It connects us to a time that was so different, and yet the techniques, the materials, the appreciation for good craftsmanship, that has endured.
A craft that has accompanied humanity from the Stone Age to today.
And that brings us to the end of this episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did.
If this topic interested you, head over to battlemerchant.com, where you'll find not only all kinds of leather products, but also many more fascinating articles about history and craftsmanship on the blog.
Feel free to stop by. Until next time.
Take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.